Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. The article I'll read today comes from the April-May 2025 edition of the Smithsonian Magazine. I hope you enjoy the program. The title, It's Always High Noon in Tombstone, by Richard Grant. Past and present have an unusual relationship in Tombstone, Arizona. Men dressed as 1880s gunfighters are forever clomping up and down wooden sidewalks with jingling spurs and holstered revolvers on their belts. Women glide past, a mix of 19th-century bordello madams, shopkeepers, and wives of wealthy burghers. Some of these costume wearers are reenactors who perform in the daily gunfight shows for tourists, but the majority are locals who are so enamored of Tombstone's history that they habitually dress in Old West clothing. We've got about 35 reenactors in the shows, at least 100 regular citizens who get dressed up regularly and who'll do it for events and special occasions, says the mayor, Dustin Dusty Escapuli, an affable man in his 70s who owns several businesses in this remote town of 1,368 people in southeastern Arizona. He doesn't do period dress himself, preferring contemporary Western ranch wear, but he describes the vintage costume play as part of the town's appeal. On big holiday weekends, many of the visiting tourists get dressed up too. It's not unusual to see 150 Wyatt Earp impersonators strutting about in long black frock coats or drinking in Wild West-themed saloons like Big Nose Kate's, where the female staff members wear 19th-century bordello outfits, and where the 1993 film Tombstone plays over and over on a big screen. In the hit Western, Kurt Russell stars as Earp, the legendary frontiersman, and the movie climaxes with the October 1881 gunfight at the O.K. Corral, the most famous gunfight in American history, and the foundation of modern Tombstone's identity. Tim Fattig, a local tour guide and author of a 956-page biography of Wyatt Earp, stands outside the two-story Victorian courthouse on Tough Nut Street, dressed in a brocaded vest and bowler hat. Of the 500,000 visitors who arrive each year, nearly all of them come because of that gunfight, he says. It was really brought home to me when I met two Buddhist monks from Vietnam. They were wearing robes. They only had a few words of English, and two of them were Wyatt Earp. Mayor Escapuli recognizes the central irony in Tombstone's identity. The town became world famous for a gunfight that lasted all of 30 seconds and did not even take place at the O.K. Corral. It was actually in an empty lot behind the corral. Moreover, townspeople at the time regarded the episode as an embarrassment. We're famous for gunfights now, but back then it was the opposite, says Escapuli, whose family has been in Tombstone for four generations. We were renowned for sophistication. We had opera houses and theaters and fresh seafood freighted in from California. The Earp story, by contrast, smacked of frontier thuggery. Yet Tombstone has learned that tourists are most attracted to the gunplay and lawlessness in its past, as portrayed and mythologized by nearly a dozen Hollywood films. The real history of the town, in which gunfighters played a very minor role, is harder to market and commodify, but it's an extraordinary tale. Tombstone was one of the richest mining districts Arizona had ever seen, producing a prodigal fortune in silver and becoming one of the last boom towns in the American West. In 1877, a tall, lanky, Pennsylvania-born prospector named Ed Schieffelin made his way from California to the Arizona Territory. James McClintock, who published a 1916 history of the region, described Schieffelin as the queerest specimen of humanity ever seen in those parts. His clothing was worn and covered with patches of deerskins, corduroy, and flannel, and his old slouch hat, too, was so pieced with rabbit skin that very little of the original felt remained. His black hair hung down below his shoulders, and his full beard, a tangle of knots, was almost as long, and he appeared to be a fur-bearing animal. Schieffelin was 29 years old and down on his luck when he declared his intention to look for gold and silver east of the San Pedro River, where the Chiricahua Apaches were still hostile. In the language of the day, U.S. soldiers told him that all he would find was his own tombstone. Instead, he made a bonanza silver strike, and in a defiant gesture, he named his first mine Tombstone. A town of the same name was founded a few miles away in 1879, in a location previously known as Goose Flats, surrounded by scrubby, thorny, rocky hills. Despite the lack of a convenient water supply and the threat from the neighboring Apaches, it experienced a rapid increase in population and prosperity, all fueled by the silver and gold deposits in the surrounding area. Miners, prospectors, businessmen, professionals, and financiers from California all flocked to the morbidly named city, along with cowboys, gamblers, swindlers, entertainers, and prostitutes. At its height, Tombstone was highly cosmopolitan, drawing fortune seekers from all over the world. Canadians numbered in the hundreds, as did Germans, Austrians, Mexicans, English, Irish, and Chinese. According to an 1880 survey, Tombstone's population also included people from Japan, Sweden, Switzerland, France, Spain, and South America. The town had been built in a hurry, without much concern for hygiene, and it was so infested with rats that it was hard to sleep. Tombstone Chronicle George Parsons wrote in his journal, "The rats ran about us all night, making great racket, rolled over on one in the night and killed him. Mashed him deader than a doornail." Cats were in high demand because of the rat problem and constantly being stolen. Parsons himself was fortunate to spot two cats on the way home from church one night, and he tried to capture them. "I was successful and hurried mine home, anxious to get there before I was clawed or bitten to death. Peace tonight amongst the rats." By the mid-1880s, the population topped 10,000, in addition to 110 saloons, 14 gambling halls, and innumerable brothels. The town had schools, churches, telephones, ice cream parlors, a bowling alley, a baseball field, an opera house, and a high-toned French restaurant, serving imported wines. A popular drink in Tombstone, belying its straight whiskey reputation, was the gin fizz, a fashionable cocktail with gin, lemon juice, sugar, and soda water. While the town prided itself as the most urbane, sophisticated place between St. Louis and San Francisco, drunkenness, gambling, and debauchery, typical of any frontier mining camp, were the hallmarks of its nightlife. The Birdcage Theater, which opened in 1881, and also served as a saloon and dance hall, is still standing and open for tours. The co-manager with her husband was a remarkable woman called Big Minnie Bignon. According to one popular fantastical legend, she once grabbed a pistol-waving troublemaker, carried him out the door, and hurled him halfway across the street. Prostitution was legal and regulated, and its practitioners were known as good time girls, ladies of the evening, and sealing experts. One describes herself as horizontally employed. Life expectancy was short for these women because of venereal disease, the habitual presence of alcohol and drugs, and impoverished living conditions. Wyatt Earp, a hard-drinking gambler, bordello enthusiast, and lawman, who arrived in Tombstone with his brothers in 1879, signed the prostitution license for the Birdcage's Josephine Serra, Sadie Marcus, who would soon become his partner. Doc Holliday, Earp's close friend and partner in the O.K. Corral gunfight, was a former dentist turned gambler and gunfighter. His girlfriend was a prostitute named Mary Catherine Haroney, better known as Big Nose Kate. Yet most of the town's residents didn't frequent the saloons and gambling halls, and according to Fatig, they wouldn't have recognized Wyatt Earp or Doc Holliday if they were dead on the sidewalk. Silver was the real business of Tombstone and the focus of its energies and attention. At least 50 mines tunneled into the hills. Many of them were engineering marvels, with state-of-the-art mills, engines, and hoists. From 1879 to 1886, the Tombstone Mining District produced $30 million in silver, around $1 billion today, making it one of the most important silver mining centers in North America. The real bonanza period only lasted from 1878 to 1882. Then twin calamities struck. The price of silver slumped, and the mines flooded with groundwater when miners hit the aquifer. Mining companies installed enormous hydraulic pumps, but they malfunctioned and then caught fire. By 1890, the population had shrunk to 1,800. In 1900, fewer than 700 people remained. It could have easily become a ghost town, but in 1927, a writer named Walter Noble Burns created a sensation with his historical novel Tombstone, an Iliad of the Southwest, in which he transformed the disreputable and largely forgotten gunfight between the Earp brothers and the Cochise County Cowboys into a high-stakes morality play between good and evil. The Earps, in Burns' telling, were essentially as pure as the Knights of the Round Table. Burns and other writers inspired by him put Tombstone back in the national consciousness and inspired several popular movies like My Darling Clementine and Gunfight at the O.K. Corral. and TV shows, such as The Life and Legend of Wyatt Earp, which aired from 1955 to 1961. When visitors started coming in earnest in the late 1950s, the residents understood that tourism could save their beleaguered town. The first gunfight reenactments had taken place in 1929 and had attracted more than 6,000 visitors, but it wasn't until the 1960s that Tombstone became established as a tourism destination. The historic district as it stands today came together in the 1980s. Six eye-catching blocks of restored 1880s storefronts and a handful of original historic buildings. For the first time, costumed actors reenacted gunfight shows daily. Dusty Escalulli says his grandfather, who had mining and ranching interests, hated the Old West tourism. He was mad because it ignored the respectable, hard-working people who built Tombstone, instead putting all the emphasis on decadence and violence. One of the main conflicts in Tombstone these days is among the reenactors themselves. There are currently 4 gunfight shows, and each has its own costume promoters soliciting customers. In 2017, following an overwhelming number of complaints from visitors and storekeepers about vulgar language and intimidation tactics, the city had to once again enforce an ordinance to keep the hawkers in separate areas. They were aggressively trying to poach each other's customers, often insulting each other's outfits as inauthentic. They were constantly fighting, says an exasperated mayor, cursing in public, shoving each other, getting into fistfights. Grown men. Tombstone has a long-standing tradition of feuding and contentiousness, reaching back to the frontier days and Escapuli's grandfather and great-grandfather, both prominent local citizens, had a theory to explain it. They said an Apache shaman put a curse on this ridge so that no two white men will ever get along here, the mayor says. I think the curse is working. Besides the conflict among gunfight shows, Escapuli says storekeepers often quarrel, yelling and filing lawsuits against each other, while citizens get into endless land disputes that keep the area's lawyers and surveyors busy. Tourism, the mainstay of the local economy, has recently opened up an unexpected new sector. 5 different ghost tours are now available to visitors, and investigators like Brian Harris of Goose Flats Paranormal consider the old Silvertown to be one of the most haunted places in the nation. Our readings are off the charts, he says. Tamara Ray, a California singer-songwriter who moved to Tombstone not long ago and started wearing vintage dresses, reports that she was drawn to the town by paranormal forces. I can feel the spirits of those who lived here, she says. I would visit and leave, and they kept calling me back. Another recent transplant is Evan Boatman, age 13, standing with his mother, Rebecca, on Allen Street. They moved to Tombstone a year ago from nearby Wachuca City. She is uncostumed, but Evan is decked out in a Reno hat, just like Val Kilmer's in the movie, and a fringed suede and leather coat, with a replica Colt 45 in his gun belt. I love the history, the reenacting, the dressing up, he says. His passion for the history and pageantry has already earned him roles in the gunfight shows, first as silent characters, a bartender, a gunshot victim, and then as Billy the Kid at the Oriental Saloon Theater. "He's the future," said his mother, as a horse-drawn stagecoach rumbles past. "I know one other kid who does this," Evan says to me, with a seriousness beyond his years. "Most don't care, but it's important to us. We're keeping the Old West alive." That completes the article. It's Always High Noon in Tombstone, by Richard Grant. This next article is titled Fancy That, Unraveling the Surprising Science That Gives Colorful Diamonds Their Special Allure, by Kayla Randall. Laid out like an orchestra in a quiet gallery room, 40 colorful gems have one of the planet's most distinguished conductors, a red diamond, 2.33 of the rarest carats in the world, shining like a little bit of magic. It's called the Winston Red Diamond, and what makes it so exceptional is the nature of its redness. Designated as a fancy red by the Gemological Institute of America, or GIA, a global authority on gems, it's one of the largest of its kind ever found. The Musaeff Red Diamond is the largest in the public record at 5.11 carats. The stone takes its name from Ronald Winston, who gave it to the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History in 2023, continuing a tradition that began with his father, Harry Winston, the famous jeweler known as the King of Diamonds, who donated the Hope Diamond to the Smithsonian in 1958. In the simplest terms, diamonds are carbon with a cubic atomic arrangement, and their shine comes from the gem's high refractive index, that is, an ability to bend light. Diamonds are full of fire, as gemologists like to put it. "There are very few red diamonds on the planet," says Gabriella Farfan, a mineralogist and curator at the museum. "And fancy red is a very specific distinction. It's not reddish brown, it's not reddish purple, it's not reddish pink, it's red." Up close, the old mine-cut diamond, shaped like a square with rounded edges, has a stunning, saturated hue. Only about 30% of natural diamonds are considered gem-worthy, and among those, less than 1% are fancy color diamonds, that is, diamonds of unusual color. While the latter come in all hues, red seems to be the rarest. Fewer than 30 or so fancy red diamonds, larger than 1 carat, exist in the public record, Farfan says. The Winston is the largest one on public display. As of this month, it's featured alongside dozens of diamonds of many colors in a new ongoing exhibition, the Winston Red Diamond and Winston Fancy Color Diamond Collection, running indefinitely at the Natural History Museum's Harry Winston Gallery. Ahead of the exhibition, Farfan invited 7 experts from the Smithsonian, the GIA, and the Paris School of Mines to examine the diamond starting late June. Farfan and her colleagues studied the diamond for more than 6 months, culminating in a paper that is now featured as the spring cover story in Gems and Gemology, the peer-reviewed journal published by the GIA. Wei Wang, Vice President of Research and Development at the GIA, helped facilitate the study of the Winston Red and emphasizes its significance. A natural diamond getting a fancy red color grade is extremely rare, he says. First, it needs to be a perfect color in that range, and then the saturation needs to be perfect as well. If it's too dark, it goes to black. If it's too light, it goes to pink. Because so few fancy red diamonds are available to researchers, Farfan says, this will probably be the most detailed study of a fancy red diamond. While the researchers had a lot of questions about the stone's origin, for example, and whose hands it has passed through, perhaps the most scientifically pressing is how and why fancy reds come to be. In their pure form, diamonds should be colorless, as carbon doesn't give off any color by itself. But sometimes a carbon atom is missing inside the diamond structure. That absence alone can produce some color because the structure is disturbed. And light interacts with the material differently. Other times the color comes from the replacement of a carbon atom by another element in the environment of the diamond when it grows. For example, gemologists attribute the color of fancy yellow diamonds to nitrogen impurities in the diamond structure. And for fancy blues, they credit boron. And with that, we have run out of time today. This article's title was Fancy That, by Kayla Randall. This has been the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I've been reading from the April-May 2025 edition of the Smithsonian. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with its premium programming. And if you missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then click on Demand Podcasts. You'll see a list of articles available. Hopefully, the one you're looking for is in that list. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.